we're talking about Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. And I about an hour ago when we were talking about the book with James Wiley, I had a slip of the tongue and I started to say Hitler's wives. But there's a reason for that, is I kept musing about it while I was reading, that in fact, in a lot of ways, each of these women that were married to the men in Hitler's inner circles were by extension married to Hitler himself. That although, with the exception of Magda Goebbels, there was, he may not have had any type of emotional connection in a broader sense or any type of attraction to these women, they had an attraction to him. And they formed a kind of harem, kind of like Hitler's harem, of women who were bending their lives to serve their master. And that meant being in these really twisted relationships in many cases with Hitler's henchmen. So I wanted to ask, and we're just going to, you know, pause for a moment in the list of the women that he features in this book and ask James Wiley next about Hitler's problems, his psychosexual problems with women, and how it interplayed with Hitler's wives. Sorry, there I go again. Nazi wives next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Many of the men that James Wiley referred to last hour who formed the relationships under the focus of Nazi wives were sexually frustrated, or they were celibate, self-imposed celibates who were creating some elaborate excuse for why they haven't had relationships with women, which then turned into problems within their marriages, where the women wanted a normal sex life with their husbands in many cases, but they were not capable. And for whatever reason that turns out to be, I do think it was interesting when we were talking about it that Hitler, it's been said that Hitler too had the same problem. He too had problems around women, and that for that, following that same pattern, you know, he declared that he must be chaste in order to be able to fully dedicate himself to the motherland or the fatherland, and that he was going to be, you know, that was the sacrifice he would have to make. But I've also heard that he had had some sort of sexual encounter when he was a soldier in World War I. What do you know? What can we verify about Hitler's life in that regard?
The best sort of guess, I think, is that, you know, he was, you know, a virgin when the First World War began. That's right. Pretty certain. He developed a crush on a young woman in Vienna, but that was, you know, she barely knew that he had those feelings. And, you know, he was fascinated by the prostitutes on the streets of Vienna, but too scared to do anything about it. And, you know, in the war, again, you know, he rarely joined his fellow soldiers in their nights out on the town. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, he probably remained pretty sexless until you get to the 1920s and he gets involved with Geli Raubel, his half-niece.
His half-niece.
Yeah.
Now, there's lots of stories about that relationship. I remember, and again, there's probably not a lot of research to support it other than comments that got made here or there, but there was, you know, some discussion even amongst actual historians about his tendency to want to be dominated, or that he forced her to do things which were humiliating to her, and or also humiliating to him, but for totally different reasons. He wanted to be humiliated, and that this was the great horror of her entrapment in that apartment when he really started to come to power. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I mean the idea that was the dynamic in their relationship does come from, you know, people within his circle during that period. But they were people who had fallen foul of Hitler, were no longer, you know, privileged with access to him. So they had an agenda in terms of making Hitler look perverted or twisted. So I'm not sure about that. I mean, I look at Hitler, I look at someone who, you know, had incredible problems with intimacy, who really was happiest around people he knew were completely devoted and subservient to him. You know, I think one of the reasons why he felt more comfortable with women was because he could dominate them. So to me, the dynamic is the other way. I mean, he chose women of a particular age. You know, Getty was in her teens. Ava Brown was in her teens when he first started dating her. Women who could not challenge him, women he could manipulate, women he could control, you know, women he could feel the boss of, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And Getty was, you know, she's very young, you know, when Hitler starts paying all this attention to her. She's a slightly giddy schoolgirl with a bit of a crush, I think, to begin with. And, you know, it's only over time does she realize that she's now become his prisoner. I mean, he had he was known as Uncle Adolf. So he had this whole persona, you know, where he would attach himself to adolescent girls and get very interested in their welfare, as he puts it. I mean, Henrietta Hoffman is a good example of that, who he knew since she was 9 years old. And equally well, Gerda Bormann, who was only 12, 13 years old when she met Hitler. I hesitate to use the word grooming, but in terms of, you know, inverted commas, his romantic relationships, it was those very young women that he went for. He couldn't bear, I think, to deal with someone who might treat him as an equal or at least, you know, be on some kind of level with him.
Well, and that also, you know, his half-niece had a relationship. She did have a boyfriend.
Yes, she did, yeah.
And he made sure that ended. It wasn't like he was interested in her welfare and her happiness.
No.
He was determined. And so if she had had, if she was crushing on him a little bit because he was so powerful and she was in awe of that, it wasn't necessarily a physical thing. And because eventually he had to, you know, take that guy, I guess it was a chauffeur or something like that.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
And send him off, you know, let's just like the Russian front, basically just get him out of the picture so that he could entrap her. And something was going on. And this is to those people which, as you say, may have had an agenda in which they were describing what they had heard Hitler wanted to have done to him, but that in the end, she ends up killing herself because she can't take another day of it. And that should speak to something. It's not just a matter of, oh, my Uncle Adolf won't let me go outside. There was something that her life had entered into some level of misery from which she thought suicide was the only way out.
Well, she was a hostage, essentially. You know, when he wasn't around to monitor her every move, you know, she was monitored by other people. You know, she couldn't even go to, you know, traditional annual festivities in Munich without, you know, two male escorts, you know, and Hitler, you know, yelled at her because the dress she was going to wear was the tiniest bit revealing. I mean, any woman who's had to deal with a possessive and obsessive partner will understand that kind of dynamic.
But that kind of dynamic speaks to, again, more of a physical intimacy, almost less like some runaway avuncular character as it does the guy who is imprisoning women in his basement in Cleveland. You know, yeah. that it was
to that, most definitely.
Yeah, which comes down to, again, to a sexual thing, and that it wasn't just he wasn't just totally hands off, that although we may never know what it was, that it seems like keeps coming back. Even as I read your account, and I think you were very prudent, and your research is, you know, you drive it very much up the middle, I kept coming back to, I feel like there's a missing piece there. That would eventually lead her to end her life, you know, and to send him into a tailspin, knowing full well that if she killed herself, that he would do exactly what he did do, which is that he became dislodged for a period of time after his half-niece's death.
Yeah, I mean, those close to him said he never recovered from it in some way or another. You know, that he was, you know, he got a lot more serious about life from that point on. And certainly I think it is reflected in his treatment of Ava Brown, which, though very similar, I think when he realized that he risked the same thing happening again, that he did make every effort to try and accommodate her. I mean, talking about Hitler's sex life, to me the most compelling evidence about his sex life came from the maids at the Berghof, you know, the housekeepers.
Right.
Because they're changing the bed sheets every day, and bed sheets do not lie. And, you know, from that evidence, from their testimony, you know, it suggests he had a pretty kind of average sex life. I mean, I just think he had quite a low libido. I think he channeled so much of that energy into his political life of being Hitler, you know.
Yeah, but I also think that's an excuse that a lot of men use, right? I'm married to my work, you know, but that they're still busted from time to time on the thing that they actually were doing, and they just used a more public acceptable excuse. But I'm glad you brought this up, because this then does say that it wasn't like he and Ava Braun were asexual until the, you know, the night that he marries her famously in the bunker, that there was something going on with her at the Berghof, and that's knowable to a point. We can know that something was happening there between them.
I mean, you know, she had the adjoining room to his bedroom, you know, and the evidence is that, you know, she would come in there and, if not spend the whole night, would spend some of the night.
And how old was she at that time? How old was she at that time?
Well, by the time they're in the Berghof, she's in her mid-20s.
Right. But this has been a relationship.
And as to I think the, you know, most historians seem to think that he did take her virginity when their relation, you know, after Gelly, there's a sort of 6-month gap, and then historians seem to think that he began sleeping with Ava Brown at that point.
And she's totally devoted to him, as are these other women. So I made a point to say that it seemed like in some ways all of these Nazi wives form this kind of odd dysfunctional harem around him. What do you think of that idea?
I think that's a very, I mean, I certainly think he was more comfortable in the company of women. I mean, as long as they adored him, obviously. And he sought out the company of women a lot. And I think, you know, unable, you know, because of his sacrifice for Germany and because of his own emotional and psychological issues, he's not capable of having a family himself. but he craved that feeling of family. So they all kind of formed an extended family with the wives and the children, you know, and he was very, very concerned that they all stay married, that there shouldn't be any divorces within his inner circle. Yeah, it was a kind of support network. I mean, it's telling that, you know, even in the depths of the war, when Hitler's ensconced in his various bunkers running the war, you know, the company he chooses every night during his, you know, his bouts of insomnia are his young secretaries.
Yeah.
You know, he would be summoned at 10 to midnight and then would sit up all night while he talked.
Yeah.
So he chose the company of women, I think, a lot of the time over men, because I think he was always feeling competitive with men, you know.
If there was one guy in the group of Hitler's inner circle of men who did seem to fit the Aryan ideal, it would be Reinhard Heydrich.
Yeah.
So talk about his wife and their relationship.
Lena Heydrich, again, I mean, she was involved with the Nazi movement before she met her husband. She's very young at the time. She's in her late teens. And, you know, they fell, you know, in love pretty quickly. But he already, you know, had got himself into trouble with another young woman, which led to him being thrown out of the Navy. And it's Lena Heydrich who really holds him together at that point and pushes him into the Nazi movement. She's the one who gets him involved in the SS, and she's there behind him, pushing him forward, even when the SS were quite a small outfit. She was extremely ambitious. I think her greatest frustration was that the more powerful he became, the kind of less power she had, strangely
right.
enough, to influence
right.
things. But the problem in their marriage was that Heydrich, you know, was addicted to prostitutes. so, you know, she was always convinced that he was having affairs, but I don't think she fully realized that actually what he was doing was, you know, trawling the brothels of Berlin.
So
she gained a terrible reputation.
And would have had Hitler, well, to what degree do we think Hitler was aware of that? And how did somehow that escape Hitler's knowledge?
I think Hitler had a slightly not standoffish relationship with Heydrich, but I think it was like, I need Heydrich to be a bad guy. You know, in a sense, if his image is bad, if people are scared of this guy and think he's capable of terrible things, that's just fine. That's kind of what he's there for, if you see what I mean. And Hitler was quite careful to, you know, he kept his distance from Heydrich. I don't know if he was slightly scared of him. Most people were scared of Heydrich.
Yeah.
I mean, people would say the temperature in the room would drop when he walked in. I mean, even Himmler was better company than he was. So, yeah, I mean, he fits, in a sense, he does fit the image of the Nazi sort of Superman.
We did mention Hess. We did mention Hess earlier and Bormann. We'll get to those two because that's the remaining of the six that James Wiley focuses on the most in Nazi Wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. But you're seeing a pattern of the women pushing the men, where we might think of the men, you know, making these big goose steps into the inner circle, but it really wasn't. And that's why these women are just as awful as the murderers that they're married to. And then we'll go over what does happen to the end. We'll run down the list of the fates of these wives next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with James Wiley, Nazi Wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. We had two more to get to, and then we're going to run down the list of their fates. We're leaving out a lot of what happens in the middle, but just suffice it to say, these are all awful people. They just are. The men are awful. They're murderers. They're criminals. They're mobsters, essentially. They live by their own twisted sense of morality, and they worship a guy who is a narcissist sociopath of the highest order. And you know, no wonder they all conspired to kill people, because they were rotten to the core. But so were their wives. And that was the part maybe that was surprising the most to read the book. We'll get to all of this, and we'll get to your calls coming up at the top of the hour. And then there was one more aspect of the book I haven't mentioned yet, but sure, maybe some of you are already wondering, like, where does the occult play into this? We know the men were heavily into this sort of phony mythology, or in some cases taking off a real occult practice and then expanding it into something else. Where were the women with that? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Let's do the occult question first, James Wiley. We know that Himmler was really into the occult, and that this was a central piece to the Nazi mythology, this connection that they had, this sort of celestial connection, and this is part of what was going to be predictive about the Thousand-Year Reich and all. What about the women and the occult in this group?
Well, the only true enthusiast was Ilse Hess, because her husband was, you know, deeply interested in the occult. Himmler's wife, I think she looked on it in the same way that, you know, a wife might look on a slightly annoying hobby her husband has.
Stamp collecting.
You tolerate it, but you don't really, you know, you're not very interested in it. And I think she certainly was never really bought into the most extreme aspects of Himmler's ideology. But Ilse Hess, she found her husband his personal astrologer. That was her recommendation and her friend. And he became Hess's astrologer in about 33-34, and he gave Hess a reading every day up until his flight to the UK.
Yeah,
she was quite happy to do all the, well, to give up her Christianity for pagan beliefs, and she was perfectly happy to try any kind of occult method they could think of so that she could conceive and they could have at least a child to add to the Führer's German masses.
She was
definitely very, very involved in the occult with her husband.
So let's set that up a little bit better, because Rudolf Hess was a leading figure. He was the deputy Führer. He had a lot of power, but he was also a really strange guy. So amongst all of the people, of all the men in these relationships, I think Hess is the one that stands out the most in my memory after reading your book, Nazi Wives. If there was a guy that was wound a little too tight, if there was a guy that I think you could make a pretty good case for was really trying to fake it as a butch straight man, it would be Rudolf Hess.
Yeah, I mean, again, these men were so contradictory, because Hess was a war hero. I mean, he was extremely brave in the First World War, and he was wounded several times. So there was the fight he had, you know, he had been a fighting man, and he loved driving a car fast, and he loved flying planes. Yet at the same time, he was a totally obsessed with his bodily functions. He was constantly ill. He's obsessive about his diet. You know, he tried innumerable numbers of sort of potions and remedies, homeopathic medicines, everything. So at one level, he was physically very weak, yet at the same time, liked to project, you know, an action man image as well.
Yeah, but I think that some of that, you know, I'm of the belief that he had a death wish. And that what we put down as bravery, he wanted to get it over with. And so he kept putting himself in harm's way, and people would marvel. He'd keep winning these wonderful awards. And then even after his second catastrophic injury, then he wants to learn how to fly. And I think he drove fast because he wanted to crash. I think he was a guy who just... That was why he was such a risk taker. It wasn't because he loved life and embraced the edge.
Oh no, I think you're absolutely right. No, it wasn't out of it wasn't sort of joie de vivre. It wasn't that sort of old fashioned adventurous.
Right.
There's that. I mean, I think I must always remember the First World War, you know, and the impact that would have had on these young men. I mean, Hess was at the Battle of Verdun. Which was the, you know, the equivalent of the Battle of the Somme for the German army. Horrific. I mean, really difficult for us to imagine how horrific those experiences must have been. I think, you know, for a guy who was already clearly quite sensitive, strange loner, even as an adolescent, you know, I think, you know, it's killed something inside him, you know, some level of humanity or something, you know, it's just kind of cauterized.
It's apathetic.
By the experience.
But that lack of passion also then plays into when he meets Ilsa. And so talk about their relationship. Because if any, I mean, there's your kind of archetypical psychosexual problem.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of young students, they're both students, you know, so it's like young students who really both fell in love with Hitler and both fell in love with his ideology. And really, that's kind of, and they both shared a love for poetry and music. So they lived a kind of a slightly idealized, almost pre-sexual kind of relationship. I mean, I think, you know, he saw her as a kind of sister almost. Or a female friend. I mean, you know, it took him years to kind of acknowledge that she was actually his girlfriend.
Right. Yeah,
she patiently sort of followed him around.
And if it weren't for Hitler, they really probably wouldn't have gotten together.
Yes, both that's right. I mean, again, Hitler had this kind of matchmaking fetish where he really, you know, he liked putting, you know, people together who were in his circle, and he did say, look, come on, you know, what about it? Why aren't you guys married yet? You've been dating for 6 years.
6 years, right?
Yeah.
And so even after they get married, then do the sparks fly?
Well, not according to Ilsa. I mean, she said to a friend that she might as well be in a convent.
Right.
So that's indicative of the lack of a physical dimension to their relationship. And I think really that part of their relationship was in the end reserved to the act of trying to have a child, which, you know, took them years to do. And even when Ilsa did finally get pregnant, you know, the rumor mill was that it wasn't Hesse's kid. It was always the chauffeur. It was always the chauffeur what done is, as it were.
Right. What done. Right. No, I love that expression.
She had her son. And of course, and that was it. She had no further children. But again, you never sensed any. There were no complaints from her, and she certainly didn't go looking elsewhere for satisfaction. And he just didn't. You know, he didn't have any affairs or anything like that, or mistresses. He just clearly was not very interested.
But then again, that is what drove them together was their love of. You know, they were unabashed anti-Semites. They loved Hitler. Yep. So, you know, this is, again, all of these women sacrificed themselves because they couldn't be, you know, these are women who, if the gender roles had been flipped, they would have been the men of the house. They would have been the women who were closer to Hitler. They would have been the ones who were doing the job. They were doing the heavy lifting, but they can't because they're women. So they find these, essentially these puppets, and they're like sock puppets. And these women, that's why it's still so extraordinary. If you read, again, we're talking about James Wiley's book, Nazi Wives, they're just as awful as the men they're married to. And they're aware of what's going on, and they have no problem with it. It doesn't offend their humanity. They're not going, you know, this isn't what we're supposed to do. And for somebody who was trying so hard to have life, she couldn't have cared less of all the other children that were being taken away from other mothers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the hardest things to grasp about that period is just how did people allow it to happen? And as you're, very well pointing out, I mean, you know, these are people so close to the most terrible decisions, some of the most terrible decisions ever made. Yet, you know, that didn't disrupt their lives. You know, they weren't lying awake at night, tossing and turning, and they weren't, you know, saying to their husbands in the morning, "Well, maybe, you know, maybe you should think twice about this," you know, or anything. And that wasn't just because they were, well, perhaps from Gerda Bormann, who was very obedient to their husband. This wasn't because these were obedient or weak women. Far from it. But it's because, as you say, they backed Hitler's ideology and were,
living vicariously through their husbands.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Gerda, because then we'll wrap up our top six. So Gerda, well, the Bormans in general kind of stand out differently. But Gerda, as you mentioned earlier, had been acquainted with Hitler since she was, what, 9 or 12 or something like that? What was the number?
Yeah, 12, 13, about that age. I mean, her father was a very early joiner of the Nazi party. So Hitler started dropping around their home, and he took interest in Gerda. And, you know, so by the time she's in her sort of mid-teens, the only world she's really known is that of the Nazis. So it's really no surprise that she, you know, the first vaguely kind of roguish and handsome Nazi who pays her any attention, she marries, which is Martin Bormann. And then she spends really her whole life within a kind of Nazi bubble, living as an ideal, you know, as an ideal Nazi wife.
In a loveless, largely loveless marriage.
Well, that's the strange thing about their relationship is that, you know, he was a brute and a bully, a thug, and, you know, those around them, you know, always remarked on how badly he treated her, and, you know, she was not much better than a servant who just produced children at a kind of epic rate. But their letters, which we have, their letters from the last few years of the war, reveal a very intensely passionate kind of relationship. The Bears is a very strange relationship. Because she was clear, you know, it was clearly she was nuts about him, and he, despite being a serial philanderer, you know, seemed to be nuts about her. So there's a real contrast between, you know, how other people saw her as a kind of meek and preyed upon wife, and their letters reveal this very intensely passionate kind of relationship.
But if we could transition there to say how she dies of a very painful death of ovarian cancer.
That's right, yes.
While he's just saving his own ass and leaving, you know, he's not doing anything for her at the end.
Well, he, pro- I mean, he, it was all set. I mean, they'd all, there was a plan. And they did have a plan.
They did have a plan.
Yeah, she was going to get to the Tyrol, in which Northern. An area that they kind of earmarked as a place to get to, as a safe haven. And, you know, Bormann was meant to join her. But, of course, he never got out of Berlin. So.
But there was, yeah, I mean, so maybe there was a plan, but, and he does die. The mystery of his death isn't solved until decades later. So, I guess, and I look at that and I would have thought, especially under those circumstances, to prioritize the woman that is central to your life when all of this is winding down and he knows there's no future in the Third Reich. And he's got other, you know, he's also, you know, part of the plan was to make sure that they weren't destitute at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was the money man. Yep.
Yeah. And, but he's on his own. I mean, he's sort of like at some point you could look at that and go, well, he didn't choose to be by her side while she's terribly ill. Just here's the plan. I'll meet you there. And she dies of ovarian cancer, advanced ovarian cancer at the end. And we don't find out until years later that he died of essentially perhaps a building falling on him, right?
Yeah.
That traps him in a building.
Under rubble, certainly. Yeah, that's the belief. Yeah.
Well, working backward, then, so as we're talking about how these women that were Nazi wives in the inner circle, how they died, let's talk about Ilse Hess.
Well, Ilse Hess outlived everybody. Ilse Hess was the last to die in 1996 at the grand old age of 96. So, you know, she was the real survivor amongst them all,
right.
And, you know, spent the last few decades of her life trying to get her husband out of prison. So fighting for Hitler's cause right to the end of her life, really.
And unrepentantly.
Completely unrepentantly, yeah. And again, you know, all about managing her husband's reputation, managing the mythology around him, and, you know, convinced that at some point or other, Nazism would, you know, reassert itself or find its time again.
Yes.
So, again, you know, my husband, you know, is innocent of the worst crimes, therefore he should be
freed,
liberated.
Right. And maybe in some ways she did get the best deal because Hess, in all of his weirdness, flew to Scotland, flew to the UK at a time before the Holocaust was known. And so he could not be held centrally responsible for what happened, even though he was a central figure otherwise. All right. So then coming back, before we're going to give the numbers in just a moment, then we'll talk about Mrs. Heydrich, Mrs. Himmler, Mrs. Goebbels and Mrs. Goering, the second Mrs. Goering. We've already talked about the first one. They were all Nazi wives, the women at the top of Hitler's Germany. Then to your questions and your comments for James Wiley. It's a very interesting book. I've left out everything in the middle. But you already get an idea what we're talking about. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.